surge in coronavirus infections. Several Indian states have run out of coronavirus vaccines, delaying a planned nationwide inoculation drive a day before its implementation. And also, the European Union slams as deeply disappointing a decision by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to delay the first Palestinian election in 15 years. Our top story for this half hour, the Eurozone economy has entered into a second recession in less than a year as growth in the 19-member monetary union is hard hit by coronavirus-related restrictions. The Eurozone's GDP shrank by 0.6% in the first 3 months of this year. That's according to the European Union's statistics office, Eurostat. The negative growth in the single currency zone follows a 0.7% contraction in the fourth quarter of 2020. Portugal recorded the highest slump compared to the previous quarter. However, Germany was Europe's worst-hit major economy, posting a quarterly contraction of 1.7%. Europe has been hit hard by a second and third wave of the pandemic. Much of the continent was subjected to some form of lockdown in the first 3 months of this year to contain infections. Our correspondent Jerome Hughes joins us now from Brussels with more on that story. Jerome, what do these numbers mean?
Well, Bardia, I mean, it's difficult to know where to start on this, but I mean, every 6 weeks or so, the European Central Bank, which manages the euro in the 19-country eurozone, it has a governing council meeting. And then after the meeting, Christine Lagarde, the president, holds a press conference. And in recent months, what she's been saying is the biggest concern in terms of the possible shock to the short-term and medium-term economic outlook relates to the slow vaccination program and the possibility of new variants as well. So that's creating a lot of uncertainty in the EU. Now, you might say, OK, well, you know, this is the coronavirus. It's a global pandemic. It's not the EU's fault. But then you have to ask the question, how is the European Union responding? And only today, from the European Commission, we got the latest information in relation to this 750 billion euro stimulus package, the recovery fund. And we found out that this is the deadline for EU countries, the 27 nations, in fact, to submit their plans to draw down on this 750 billion euro. And guess how many have actually submitted plans? Only five. So it shows that, you know, we had a very slow process from the European Commission's point of view in terms of signing contracts with pharmaceutical firms for the vaccine. Then we had a slow process with the European Medicines Agency in terms of approving vaccines. Now we're having a slow reaction in terms of actually administering vaccines. Less than 10% of the population have received both doses, so they're fully vaccinated. That's less than 5%. In fact, less than 10%, to be precise, 8% of people. And now we have a situation where the governments are given an opportunity to actually submit plans to draw down on this funding, and they've been so slow to do so. I mean, they've known about this funding now for months. It was agreed last summer, in fact, by the EU leaders. And actually, the 750 billion euros sounds like a lot of money, but it's actually quite small. But you can look at towards the United States and the trillions of euro in terms of the stimulus package there. And here you have a situation where just five countries have submitted plans. And there's no guarantee, Bardia, as well, that actually these plans will be accepted by the European Commission, because there is clear criteria in terms of what the money can be spent on and so on. And therefore, we don't know actually the credibility or the quality of these plans. That's something we'll have to wait and see. But the question is, what about all those other countries that haven't submitted the plans? And in terms of the reaction, you mentioned lockdowns and this impact on the economy. Well, we have all sorts of different restrictions in place right across the 27 nations. Some are opening hairdressers, but not other shops. Some are opening shops, but you can only go there by appointment. And some places, cafes and restaurants are open, so you have people traveling across the border, for example, to the Netherlands, which is doing that now with restaurants and cafes. People from Belgium going over there because they're closed here. And so there's this sort of hickledy-pickledy lack of coordinated response to the coronavirus. Again, of course, we can say that the EU is not to blame for this pandemic, but the question marks surround how is it actually reacting.
And 1 year, over a year on from the start of the coronavirus crisis, we're still pretty much faced with the same questions. How are countries, when we're talking right now about European countries, are they going to carry out this delicate balancing act of keeping the economy afloat, but also trying to keep people safe?
Well, it depends on which country you're talking about. If you look at Ireland, for example, that has a small population, just below 5 million, and it can afford to basically have these very strict lockdowns and close everything down, which it has done for more or less for a year now, because, it's a small economy and it's a relatively small population. Other economies just can't afford to do that. And the thing is that the support for the businesses and so on, that money is going to run out. They've been paid by governments to stay closed, and also individuals have been paid to stay at home. And the question is, what's going to happen now when they're allowed to reopen? Well, if you look at different central banks across the EU, they're saying that many businesses just won't reopen once the support funding runs out. So the statistics in terms of coming from the Central Statistics Office, they're very skewed, because we don't know the true factor. We don't know how many jobs are going to be lost. That is just a complete unknown at the moment, when businesses reopen. And we don't know how many businesses will reopen. So it's a very unclear picture. I mean, if you look, you mentioned about the Balancing Act in terms of trying to keep economies afloat. I think if you look at Belgium, it's actually done a very good job, in the sense that, yes, it has quite high caseloads per day, in the region, averaging out of 4,000 new cases a day. But actually, it kept the schools open, and it did keep, for a large portion of the time, it did keep non-essential retail open. Only they've lifted restrictions. Now you have to make an appointment to go into non-essential retail outlets. Now you don't. But the point is, it did actually strike a decent balance between restrictions to try and keep the coronavirus at bay to a certain extent. I mean, a population of 11 million people and on average 4,000 cases a day. It's very, very consistently around 4,000 cases a day. So yes, that's quite high when you consider Ireland, for example, which has half the population and is strict lockdown, and actually it's keeping its caseloads well down. I mean, you're talking about 300 cases a day. So there is that balancing act, and I suppose it could be argued that some countries have done better than others.
All right, thanks a lot. Jerome Hughes joining us from Brussels. Elsewhere, new protests have been held in Italy's capital, Rome, as tens of thousands of workers fear losing their occupation. More than 500,000 jobs have been lost in Italy since the start of the pandemic last year. Max Gibbidi reports.
The socioeconomic malaise that has been worsened by the COVID crisis is erupting at an unprecedented level everywhere in Italy. Many hundreds of large and small-scale protests have been held across the country over the past months. On Wednesday, thousands of street vendors staged a protest against a city decision to stop the extension of their licenses. They blocked the capital's Ring Road and occupied the central Republic Square, as tens of thousands of itinerant street trading businesses are at risk of closure due to an EU directive on free trade.
Italy has been under attack since the EU introduced the Bolkestein Directive, which aims at establishing a single market for services. Our Parliament has already opposed the adoption of this provision.
We have been abandoned in these testing times. How dare they? The mayor wants to impose standards in Rome. She's killing us.
Also on Wednesday, pilots, flight attendants and other airline industry workers gathered in central Rome to stage a protest against a rescue plan to save the bankrupt former national airline Alitalia. The airline is running out of cash for fuel and salaries, and workers fear some 7,000 employees will be sacked if a buyout offer by a group of investors gets the green light from the government.
The government is not listening to our demands. We have not even been paid last month. That's how Alitalia special commissioners are treating us.
The Draghi government is not used to listening to workers' needs. I am afraid this executive can only make unpopular decisions.
Recently, Italy's parliament has overwhelmingly approved the government's European Union-funded pandemic recovery plan, worth 248 billion euros. Prime Minister Draghi has pledged the plan would address both the damage caused by COVID and the country's long-standing structural issues.
Italy is at a crossroads. There is the risk that the pandemic may turn into an unprecedented socio-economic crisis that will drag on for a very long time. But Italians also have the opportunity to use the funds from a vigorous stimulus package of the EU to relaunch employment and growth. It remains to be seen whether the country will succeed in this process. Max Civili, Rome.
Germany has reported more than 24,300 new cases from coronavirus in the past 24 hours, a figure declined by 400 compared with the daily case tally reported Thursday. Germany's total cases are now over 3.38 million with nearly 83,000 deaths. On Thursday, Health Minister Jens Spahn said the number of infections seems to be heading lower. But he added the decline is not yet deep enough to suggest that the third wave of the pandemic has been broken. Germany's efforts to contain the third wave is complicated by the more contagious UK variant and a relative slow start to its vaccination campaign. Officials say few cases of the Indian variant have been detected as well. In India, several states have run out of COVID-19 vaccines as daily infection cases set another global record. The shortage comes a day before a planned nationwide inoculation drive. Officials in the capital, New Delhi, and Karnataka state have announced that the vaccination drive for adults would not begin on Saturday, urging citizens not to show up at vaccination centers. Authorities in the financial capital of Mumbai have also announced shutting down inoculation centers for 3 days from Friday. India has reported yet another record single-day infections of over 386,000 and nearly 3,500 more deaths since Thursday. The explosion in infections has caused a severe shortage of hospital beds and oxygen supplies. We earlier talked to our New Delhi correspondent Munawar Zaman about the coronavirus crisis in India. He told us how tragic the situation is as the country is grappling with an explosion in cases.
Well, the hospitals have broken down. They're overwhelmed. There is nothing they can do. They're trying their hard to save as much as life they can. And you wouldn't imagine. They have to make a choice, whom to give the oxygen, whom to give the ventilator. I mean, they have to make a decision in seconds, depending on whose conditions is what. I mean, the situation is out of words. There is no word that can describe the situation. Till yesterday, we were talking about shortage of oxygen supplies and shortage of beds. Now, that's something which is not to be spoken about now. Now, the biggest trouble the country is facing is the lack of crematoriums, lack of food, lack of burial grounds. I mean, it is the biggest trouble now the country is facing because people have to queue up to get their loved ones buried, to get their loved ones cremated because there is no space left.
Iran has logged more than 19,000 new COVID-19 infections, raising its total caseload to almost 2.5 million. The Iranian Health Ministry also confirmed 407 new fatalities for the past day. The country's death toll is now inching closer to 72,000. Nearly 2 million people have so far recovered from the deadly disease. More than 5,000 COVID patients are currently in intensive care units. Iran has been grappling with the fourth wave of the pandemic since late March. Nearly 200 cities are now designated as red, the highest level in the country's four-tier system of COVID restrictions. Stringent measures are in place in those cities to curb the spread of the virus. The European Union has condemned a decision by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to postpone the first Palestinian elections in 15 years. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, called the decision deeply disappointing. He said a new date should be set without delay. Legislative and presidential elections were due to be held on May the 22nd and July the 31st, respectively. But on Friday, Palestinian President Abbas delayed them. He cited a lack of assurances by Israel that voting would take place in East Jerusalem al-Quds. Various Palestinian groups criticized the move. Resistance movement Hamas called the decision a coup against its partnership with Abbas's party Fatah. Hamas was expected to do better than Fatah in the polls. During his first address to Congress, the U.S. president said he will make sure that America will not lose in the geopolitical competition against its rivals. Joe Biden's remarks are seen as a warning to Russia and China, but will America be able to contain other superpowers?
During his term in office, former U.S. President Donald Trump kept boasting about his tough line on China. Trump imposed unprecedented trade sanctions on Chinese companies. His administration also raised military tensions with Beijing over Taiwan and in the South China Sea, where Beijing has many territorial claims. Some observers went so far as to warn that Trump's dangerous policies pushed the two sides to the brink of conflict. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, has been widely expected to change course. Under Biden, America seems to have toned down anti-China rhetoric. But the geopolitical rivalry between the two global arch-rivals remains intense. Biden's administration has made clear that it will stick to the aggressive trade policies followed by the previous administration against Beijing. This week, in his first speech to a joint session of Congress, Biden talked tough on China. During his address, the U.S. president left no doubt that America will do its utmost to outpace the Asian superpower in terms of trade and technology.
We will defend America's interest across the board. America will stand up to unfair trade practices that undercut American workers and American industries, like subsidies from state to state-owned operations and enterprises, and the theft of American technology and intellectual property.
Biden identifies China as the toughest foreign policy challenge facing America. The U.S. president also said the American military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch rival. Meanwhile, the U.S. president seems to be more serious than his predecessor in trying to contain America's other geopolitical rival, Russia.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran today.
JCPOA Vienna talks are into their third week, but as talks failed to conclude, parties agreed to forming a third expert working group to focus on steps to restore the nuclear deal or JCPOA. Perhaps three's the charm that will align Iran's expectations and America's intentions to achieve that goal. Iran sees three steps to reviving the deal, the first of which is sanction lifting by the U.S. But the U.S. categorizes sanctions into three sets, not all of which are meant to be lifted. So where does that leave the JCPOA or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action? Hanging. With hope, dim as those hopes might be. But do they have to be? Stay with me, Leila Faromazi, on Iran Today to hear what some experts have to say. Hopes are misplaced in the third working group. It can't be an easy task to aim straight where delegations from each power party to the deal have failed to hit the target. That target being the revival of a deal the former U.S. administration officially binned in 2018. Mr. Kanani Moghaddam is one to ask for a realistic look at the present, which tends to make for viable predictions of the future.
The process of talks looks like a seesaw. I feel like the P5 plus 1 is putting its weight on the one side, so we have to give concessions to strike a balance. In game theory, there is a concept called balance, the win-win game. We haven't had a winning point yet. This means when a decision is made, no one should regret it. If not, we haven't followed the rules of the game. We're not at a point with the Americans, which if a decision is made, both sides will feel they have won. If this happens, commitments will remain in place. Otherwise, it may be us walking away this time.
Iran's three steps to revival are first, that sanctions be lifted off this country by the U.S. Second, that Iran verifies that sanctions have indeed been lifted. And third, that remedial nuclear steps be reversed by Iran. But then, the first step itself is a hurdle, looking at the U.S.'s categorization of sanctions. It describes them as 1, sanctions it must remove to resume compliance. 2, those it does not need to remove and would not remove. And 3, a category of difficult cases where the answer is uncertain.
Mr. Trump has imposed several additional sanctions related to the JCPOA, which are currently being discussed. Since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, there have been some sanctions against Iran, such as human rights sanctions or those regarding regional and arms issue. These have to be discussed under a separate framework. But the clever trick Americans use is that they tie everything together. Our central bank, for example, has been sanctioned 3 or 4 times over. Suppose the U.S. lifts the central bank sanctions, but the other sanctions remain untouched.
To give you a quick glimpse of who's who and in charge of what with regard to what's passed, Iran's verification of sanction lifting will have to be carried out by its central bank, petroleum ministry, and transport ministry. If it comes to that, verification will take at least 3 months. Because Iran will have to first get its crude oil flowing back into the global markets to the same amounts as under the 2015 nuclear deal. Only then can it be sure sanctions have worked. Mr. Qadiri Abiyane was Iranian ambassador to Mexico. He now directed his trip to Press TV studios to share his thoughts with us. Let's hear him out.
Americans say negotiations are successful when they are backed up by something. What can back them up? Military sanctions, the terrorist operations we have recently witnessed, and economic pressure. Diplomacy without something to back it up doesn't make sense. Mr. Zarif participated in the UN Resolution 598 in the 1980s, when we were in a war with Iraq. Negotiations wouldn't go anywhere if we had not liberated lands and taken several prisoners. We cannot allow Daesh to infiltrate Iran with the support of the West and repeat the atrocities it committed in Syria and Iraq. Diplomacy must serve the interests and security of Iran.
So far, what Press TV has learned is that the U.S. has only agreed to a short one-week verification period in which several transactions are symbolically performed, and that anyway the U.S. intends to lift some sanctions temporarily over a long period of time. Basically, the U.S. is considering lifting only JCPOA-incorporated sanctions, whereas punitive measures against Iran, which were imposed after the 2015 JCPOA signing, also cast a shadow on the spirit of the deal.
The Americans don't want the problem to be solved. My example is the game of snakes and ladders. We have been negotiating for 18 years. We climb the ladder only to get to a certain point and go back to square one. This must not happen. This is why the leader of the Islamic Revolution said the negotiations are not carried out for the sake of negotiations. The negotiations should not become exhaustive. The sanctions must be lifted, and that verification must be done.
As for today's working groups, the first two expert working groups in Vienna were tasked with drafting a comprehensive list of the sanctions the U.S. would need to lift and the nuclear steps Iran would have to reverse out of. It's the JCPOA Joint Commission that decides on working groups, just as it is responsible for overseeing implementation of the JCPOA. You must wonder how our experts of the day weigh the Vienna talks and whether they presume a timeline for a possible successful conclusion of talks. Mr. Beheshtipur, an honest pundit, was once the news bureau manager here at Press TV. He now joins us on Skype.
In my opinion, the conditions set by Iran are unattainable during the negotiations, because Iran has said that all sanctions should be lifted and then they should be verified. You know that there are over 1,500 sanctions against Iran. It's virtually impossible to remove all of them in the process of the underway negotiations. Why is that? Because the American side is using the sanctions as leverage against Iran. If the United States lifts all sanctions, it will have virtually lost that leverage.
I have already said it before regarding the JCPOA. I believe that we will enter into an agreement with the Americans and the P5+1 and sign a text about it. But that text will not be implemented as many obstacles are blocking it. Some sanctions may be lifted, but nothing will change.
Iran is cool with returning with no results, as the U.S. is killing time by mulling what it can and can't do to push things forth. But regardless of Iran's 18th June elections, any action, if intended, best be taken soon. European officials are aware of that, given they said they hope to have something concrete in hand by mid-May, before a monitoring agreement between Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog expires later that month. Not to forget, the quicker the effort, the less room for sabotage of talks and results by outside elements. Israel, for one, has vowed not to let Iran's peaceful nuclear program advance. And now even the UN nuclear watchdog is all of a sudden referring to uranium traces in unexpected parts of Iran. This is while the watchdog had verified 15 times that Iran has been in full compliance with the nuclear deal.
They were able to carry explosives into a heavily guarded nuclear facility and detonate them. Can't they take the radioactive material elsewhere, contaminate it, and then say it is contaminated? If they could bring explosive inside, there won't be a problem for them to bring radioactive material inside. The same agents who were able to infiltrate could send a uranium residue elsewhere and then say it is contaminated here. That's their goal. Even a female inspector of the IAEA was found with nuclear material on her when she was entering the Natanz nuclear facility. They refused to let her in. I think she should have been arrested and tried.
Just a quick reminder, the very purpose of the deal was to limit Iran's nuclear program in return for nuclear-related economic UN sanctions to be lifted off this country. in order to help Iran's foreign trade and economy. Other parties to the deal would, of course, have to invest in this by, say, buying oil from this country. Iran complied, but Trump's USA, ever unsatisfied, unilaterally pulled out of the deal on 8th May 2018. On the anniversary of that day, Iran started reversibly inching out of its commitments and is now enriching uranium up to 60% purity. That's up from 3.67%. Iran is happy to return to full commitment within the letter of the JCPOA if the US does so, and if other Western parties rise from their sleeping partner status. Parties were Iran on one side and the P5 plus one on the other. With the US pullout, we were left with P4 plus one. That's the UK, France, Russia, China, plus Germany.
The Europeans are serious about returning to the JCPOA. To them, the accord is a non-proliferation agreement and very important. But the reality is that there is nothing they can do about American financial hegemony. In practice, we saw that in May 2018, the United States unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA and virtually told everyone that you are either dealing with me or with the other side. Nearly all Chinese and Russian companies left Iran altogether. Europeans too. In other words, the Europeans did not and do not have the power to oppose US sanctions. So now, what the Europeans can do is act as a mediator.
It's back to the present, but with a quick look at other media outlets first. Always worth hearing what others have to say on one's matters of concern. And here are the words their thoughts were put into. Beginning with Deutsche Welle, Iran nuclear deal, signs of progress, but doubts linger. Despite the chasm between the two nations, the US official did hint at the next step towards possible sanctions relief for Iran. The US are not officially represented at the talks in the Austrian capital, but Washington can make its presence felt by intermediaries. As a result, the official said the US had highlighted 3 points over the sanctions it is currently imposing on the Islamic Republic. Sanctions the White House is prepared to lift, those it is not, and sanctions that still require further examination. The official did not specify which sanctions fall into which category, but said the third group is the most problematic. It's because it includes measures that current officials believe may have been imposed by the previous administration simply to make any possible Iran return more difficult. An alleviation of sanctions will almost certainly be opposed by Israel, which regards Iran as a threat, as well as Persian Gulf Arab states wary of Tehran over similar fears. A local daily, Tehran Times, has it. Iran rejects gradual revival of JCPOA as EU mulls sequential return. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stated that Iran has a definite nuclear policy that will guide Iranian negotiators. The country's policy on the interaction with the JCPOA sides and on the nuclear deal itself has already been explicitly declared. This policy will not be violated in any way. It is a policy which has already been announced and which is adopted with everyone's agreement. It is not the case that this policy was an exception to other policies. Everyone has agreed to it, the leader said in a televised speech on March 21st. This policy is that the Americans should lift all sanctions. After that, we will verify. If the sanctions have been lifted, we will return to our JCPOA commitments. We will return without any problem. This is a definite policy. We do not consider American promises to be valid. If they say they will lift them on paper, this is of no use. What is necessary is action. They should lift the sanctions in practice. Subsequently, we will verify their statements to make sure the sanctions have been lifted. Then we will resume our commitments, he continued. We've got a piece by Sputnik News. Iran says Vienna JCPOA talks on right track will return to compliance once sanctions are lifted. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh has shared information on the ongoing talks by the Joint Committee of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in Vienna, saying that the negotiations are currently dealing with the technical details of the U.S. return to compliance and lifting sanctions against Tehran. He also noted that although some progress has been made, not all disputes have yet been resolved between the parties. We are at a difficult and complicated stage, but based on the leader's stances, we seek to ensure the interests of the people and think that the talks are on the right track, Khatibzadeh said. The spokesperson added that the negotiations in Vienna would go smoother if Washington abandoned Trump's failed legacy and just agreed to fulfill its commitments under the JCPOA. And that would be it for the news segment. Back to our narrative. Regarding what matters, China and Russia, Iran's fellow Eastern parties to the deal, have spoken in favor of Iran's stance. That is for an uncomplicated revival of the deal by simply following JCPOA terms to the letter. Wang Kun, the Chinese envoy to the United Nations and other international organizations in Vienna, said, "Complete lifting of all relevant sanctions, including those on Iran and third parties, is the key to the success of the current negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal."
The United States has been adding to the list of countries under sanctions: China, Russia, Venezuela, and others. China and Russia also voted against Iran in the resolutions passed by the UN Security Council, but they are now under sanctions themselves. The more of these sanctioned countries are there, the more they cooperate, to the dismay of the United States. US sanctions have made many countries try to get rid of the dollar, a move which is very dangerous for the United States. The share of the dollar in the foreign exchange reserves of countries has fallen sharply and will fall even lower.
Mr. Kanani Moghaddam is not impressed by words paired with inaction.
"We cannot accept America's promises. Other signatories must guarantee it. What's their purpose in their talks, after all, other than monitoring and guaranteeing the agreement? Russia and China seem to be sitting aside while the Europeans and Americans are cooperating. We're left alone. It shouldn't be like that. We mustn't be forced to agree to anything the Americans say."
On the other hand, Russia's representative to international organizations in Vienna, Mikhail Ulyanov, tweeted that there is no realistic alternative to the JCPOA. He wrote, "Why do almost all countries support restoration of the JCPOA? Because it is a key element of the international non-proliferation architecture. The deal, if restored, can provide credible assurances of peaceful character of the Iranian nuclear program via intrusive IAEA verification."
Both Iran and the United States wanted the talks to begin because the Iranian side had suffered billions of dollars in losses of the Iranian people's money because of the continuing oppressive sanctions imposed on it. It seems that there was no solution other than negotiations to solve this problem. At the same time, they claimed their consent about Iran's nuclear advancements. That's why I believe both sides needed the negotiations to take place.
As each side to the deal has come with fixations of its own, each seems to assess the outcome quite differently from the next. The critical question Iran faces is not, is the U.S. serious about re-entering the deal? Rather, it is, what would be the U.S.'s intention for re-entering?
If the U.S. really wants to return to the JCPOA, why would that be?
The ultimate goal of the United States is to overthrow the Islamic Republic, disintegrate Iran, and seize its oil resources. That's because the U.S. is concerned about losing its position as the single superpower. The world is becoming multipolar. China, India, Japan, Russia, and others are getting stronger, and the Islamic world is uniting.
While talks may have appeared to have progressed, a senior U.S. State Department official implied a day later that talks were likely to require several rounds, saying, "There still are disagreements, and in some cases, pretty important ones. We are not near the conclusion of these negotiations. The outcome is still uncertain. We have made some progress."
Thing is, Iran has said it will no longer linger and accept unwritten promises. All parties are seeking guarantees the U.S. won't just pull out of the JCPOA again at will. But the U.S. sees no feasibility in a guarantee that the next administration might pull out of. But then, what of guarantees the present U.S. administration will act reliably? This is necessary, given even the Obama administration imposed sanctions after the 2015 JCPOA signing, and also given present Republicans in Congress, U.S. Congress, have recently, days ago, unveiled on Wednesday the 21st of April, the largest ever package of Iran sanctions ever in history, as they put it. The bill, which has been dubbed the Maximum Pressure Act, would formally codify the Trump administration's tough sanctions campaign on Iran and would force the Biden administration to submit any revamped nuclear deal with Iran to Congress for review before it is approved. However, Iran will not accept a revamped deal.
The President of the United States has a lot of power. He could suspend congressional resolutions. That is, he does not have the power to repeal congressional resolutions. So, he can't cancel the Congress's laws against Iran, even if he wants to, which he doesn't. But it can use its power to suspend Iran's sanctions, as the Obama administration did, which was repeated on three occasions during the Trump administration.
The Wall Street Journal cited two people familiar with the matter as saying Washington was open to easing terrorism sanctions against Iran's central bank, its national oil and tanker companies and key sectors, including steel and aluminium.
I'm sure Biden will not lift the sanctions. If it wants to lift even the sanctions imposed by the JCPOA, it must return more than $100 billion to Iran. It will not do so. For this reason, I believe that the strategy of our foreign ministry is based on a kind of undue trust in the United States. America is not trustworthy at all. It wasn't under Obama and Trump, neither is it under Biden.
Analysts have said it is inevitable the United States would have to ease some of its terrorism-related sanctions if there is to be a revival of the deal, because without this, Iran would be unable to resume exporting oil. The newspaper cited one senior European official as saying that Washington has also signaled potential sanctions relief for sectors including textiles, autos, shipping, and insurance. They don't all matter equally to Iran, however.
If our central bank is under sanctions, it can never finance nor trade, take its revenue from selling oil, or engage in domestic and international trade. It will be an absolute boycott. The central bank may be under several sanctions, JCPOA-related, American, European, human rights-related ones, and those under 20 to 31. If the U.S. lifts one, the other three remain in place. So we need to write out our demands and establish a framework, pass it through relevant authorities, and then submit that to the U.S. as a draft proposal.
Without lifting key sanctions that have hampered Iran's economic activities, any agreement would be indeed meaningless. JCPOA 2 and 3 are out of the question for Iran, but even the present JCPOA, the one and only, would mean nothing if, say, visa and ISA sanctions were not lifted. The anti-Iran sanctions imposed by former U.S. President Barack Obama's administration under the so-called Iran Sanctions Act, ISA, and the visa program will have to be terminated. So it's not just Trump-era sanctions the United States will have to fully remove, as Iran will not agree to a temporary lifting of the sanctions or their waiver.
It is expected that some of the important sanctions for Iran, namely those related to Tehran's oil sales, the central bank, and bans on Iran's sale of petrochemical material, will be either lifted or suspended in a very optimistic scenario, just as it was before May 2018.
There's been no direct or indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. It's other parties to the deal separately informing each of the two on one another's stance in Vienna. But so far, what we've got from a U.S. official is this statement. There are many other forms of sequencing that one could discuss, and we are open to that. But we are not going to accept a process in which the U.S. acts first and removes all the sanctions that it is committed to removing before Iran does anything. And although Russia's lead negotiator Ulyanov said on Monday, 19th of April, that a joint text is being drafted as representatives have moved from general words to agreeing on specific steps towards restoring the JCPOA, Iran doesn't appear inclined to budge from demanding all or nothing. All sanctions are to be scrapped in one stroke, and then Iran starts recommitting to the deal. And that'll be all for today, but the best is yet to come as parties get closer to whatever the outcome of the talks. So do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after. Till then, bye.
the limelight.
Pentagon commanders and the Central Intelligence Agency seem to be tweaking Biden's decision to withdraw by September, says M.K. Bhatnagar, writer, in an article published under the heading Big Caveats to U.S. Exit from Afghanistan. Stay tuned for the details, please. The United States and NATO are yet to begin the withdrawal of their forces from Afghanistan, but their eyes are cast over the horizon and what is in place after the forever war formally ends. Evidence is piling up that U.S. President Joe Biden's April 14th declaration on total troop withdrawal by September 11th may not be the last word on that topic. The Pentagon commanders and Central Intelligence Agency seem to be tweaking the decision. On the day after Biden spoke, the New York Times reported under the byline of two of the paper's noted senior correspondents that the Pentagon, American spy agencies, and Western allies are refining plans to deploy a less visible but a still potent force in the region to prevent the country from again becoming a terrorist base. The Pentagon is discussing with allies where to reposition forces, unquote. The report said that although NATO forces would formally withdraw, Turkey, a member of the alliance, is leaving troops behind who could help the CIA collect intelligence. Besides, some of the Pentagon contractors or mercenaries, who include 6,000 American personnel, could also be redeployed. The Times report also disclosed that the Pentagon actually has about 1,000 more troops on the ground than it has publicly acknowledged. The murky accounting results from some special operations forces having been put off the books to include some elite Army Rangers who work under both the Pentagon and the CIA. The Pentagon might even slip these undisclosed troops into Afghanistan after the departure deadline of September 11th. On the same day as the Times report appeared, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, speaking from Kabul, confirmed to the media after talks with Afghan government officials that even when our troops come home, our partnership with Afghanistan will continue. Our security partnership will endure. There is a strong bipartisan support in Washington for that commitment to the Afghan security forces, unquote. Blinken sidestepped the scale of any future CIA presence in Afghanistan, the tricky part. Suffice to say, even as the U.S. and North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, are preparing formally to withdraw forces from Afghanistan, the Pentagon and CIA are calibrating their future operations in the country, notionally to assist Afghan security forces, but in reality, in pursuit of the larger regional interests of Washington. Interestingly, after his return from Afghanistan, Blinken announced an additional civilian assistance of $300 million to Kabul as part of commitment to invest in and support the Afghan people, as he claimed. This is laughable, coming as it comes at a juncture when, as the Washington Post reported from Kabul recently, the scramble for peace in Afghanistan is fracturing Kabul's political leadership and undermining the government. Is Blinken so hopelessly out of touch with the situation in Kabul? The bottom line is that the CIA is pushing ahead with its blueprint to use Afghanistan as a staging post to destabilize Russia, Iran, and China. On the other hand, the postponement of the high-level conference in Istanbul from April 24th to May 4th means that the peace process has been derailed and the Doha Pact May's first deadline for U.S. troops' withdrawal stands erased. Put differently, Washington has shifted the goalposts. Biden also failed to mention in his speech that there are tens of thousands of private military contractors employed in Afghanistan. According to the Times, more than 16,000 civilian contractors, including over 6,000 Americans, now provide security, logistics, and other support in Afghanistan. The Times did not see fit to ask how the war can be declared over if mercenaries remain on the ground, or nor Biden can declare the war to be ending if airstrikes will continue. Hakim Naim is an Afghan-American lecturer in the Department of History at the University of California, Berkeley. He was raised in Afghanistan and lived in multiple countries as a refugee and immigrant before moving to the U.S. In an interview, he explained what Biden refused to mention, that the U.S. created chaos by supporting the most corrupt elite groups and created a mafia system of economy run by the drug lords, warlords, and contractors. Worst of all, the Taliban is back in power, he said, implying that Afghanistan is in essence back where it started in 2001. Fahima Ghaiz, the director of the Afghan Women's Fund, concurred, saying that the United States made a bigger mess in Afghanistan and lost too many opportunities to help Afghans to fix the problems that the U.S. itself created 40 years ago. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: several Indian states